Welcome back to Stories from the Ashes, where we pontificate on good books and the stories that define and refine us. I'm Amber Sauter, and I'm so glad to be joined again today with Valerie Brandt and Aaron Hutch Hutchings. So Hutch is back to talk with us about the book Echo Mountain by Lauren Wolk. When Hutch and I first spoke before we recorded anything, I had asked him if he would read that book and come back and talk with us about it because I felt like it was in his wheelhouse and it was a book I had loved and I thought the two would make a good match. And gratefully, they did, and he is back to talk with us. So let's get into it.
All right. Thanks for being here today, Hutch and Val. We really appreciate it. And we are excited to talk about Echo Mountain by Lauren Wolk, which is one of her standalone books. So Hutch, the first time I ever talked with you when Charlessa was introducing us, I got really excited about everything that you were talking about. And I was like, have you read Echo Mountain? And you hadn't yet. I was like, please read Echo Mountain. I would love to hear how you would bring Echo Mountain to life as a survival specialist. So you've read it now. And what were your impressions?
For me, the first time I go through books, a lot of times it's kind of an intense process. And then I end up rereading a lot of stuff because I do like to pause about every paragraph. I like to smell the campfire. I like to be as scared as Bilbo Baggins is, you know, or I want to be as angry as Harry Potter is, whatever, at certain times. So the first time through, it was a little overwhelming to me because it was a book I was unfamiliar with, but it was just so loaded with heritage skills. And in my literacy outreach program, I'm always looking for ideas where I can bring books to life, bring stuff to people. And this book was much like Hatchet or My Side of the Mountain. A lot of books I work with, it's showing how is Bilbo comfortable or what would Tarzan have done? They're sort of fed to you. Other books is more of a bit of a stretch, you know, Beatrix Potter, how did the duck make its shelter, you know? But this book was almost as if the author and I had collaborated. And she had said, oh, you teach at local museums and you're looking for a heritage skills book where you can talk about everything from the psychology of survival to just getting the job done throughout the day to learning new skills. And it was the easiest book in the world for me to teach is My Side of the Mountain because it's one of my favorite books. But I would put this in probably my top 10 fictional books for getting people interested in any of these outdoor skills, not just survival, but heritage skills, camping, even just walking up trails. If we can get them playing anything, whether it's, I mean, Ellie is obviously possibly a witch, probably a doctor, right? but if we can even get them interested in this, how wonderful. And the other thing that I liked is it had a female lead, which is not so common in the good books in my genre, which kind of cracked me up because it's dedicated to her two sons. So the romantic side of my brain couldn't help but wonder, is this the author's story? Is this the story the author wished she had? What is she trying to teach her boys something? And yet, sometimes I over-romanticize the author part. But I was very, very, very curious about that. So
yeah, one of the things that I love about it is I just absolutely lost my train of thought. I was holding it the whole time you were talking. I was like, oh, I want to.
Sorry, I do that.
No, it's absolutely me here. I know what I was going to say. I do know real quick. Ellie's not a witch. I do love that. I totally understand that joke. But she is a highly sensitive person, which I really appreciate. Is like, this is a form of neurodiversity. Is somebody who is that abnormally in tune to everything that's happening around them.
That's actually one of my favorite parts of the books because in my world, more people are like, our ancestors were amazing and they could do so many things that they're not often given credit for. They were very rarely naked or afraid. They weren't bumbling through. The things that they figured out through observing and listening, even the way they just converse. And I'm not just talking about Indigenous Americans, wherever you're from, your ancestors were very, very similar to this. If you trace it far enough back before we lost our way.
I agree.
And so often people are depicted as this sort of Green Beret, kill them all, eat everything, kind of an outdoor survival book. And those are normally not written by actual outdoor experts because those people very rarely make it. And Ellie reminded me of so many people that I know because in my world, you have to be very intuitive. You have to really care about people. You have to, if I use examples, am I spoiling? Is that, I mean, is, do people,
no,
are spoilers
so we,
okay?
We told everybody to read this book okay. before they showed up. So.
Okay. I just had a moment of panic there. But in Ellie, we see something. So like in our live classes, for example, and we don't do this in every class, but we do have a class that's based around butchering. And I come in and teach them how to make hide glue and use the rest of the animal. And people don't realize, first off, how much we put into making that animal comfortable while it is alive. What a mm-hmm. great life that animal happens. How mercilessly we do take its life. And then how afterwards, we're very conscious of how we use every inch of that, every inch literally. I mean, even the yeah. scrapings that we don't feed them to the dog, we make glue out of them. And we see this in Ellie. We see this in... She has a dad to save, a mentor to save, you know, and one of her first thoughts is often the bees that she might be killing when she mm-hmm. collects this honey, or she goes through this big, long process of getting a medicine for her father. But when she runs into a neighbor in need with his horse, she willingly, without, I forget the lady's name, but there's a very unfavorable character in the book who has gotten free things from the family, but won't even spare a tablespoon of honey with that
right.
getting out of the deal. And we meet too many people like that. But here we've got Ellie who just genuinely sees a need, and she has this continuous, I love this quote. I even wrote it down to add to my other classes. She says it about the bucket, but then very subtly, she says it about herself numerous times in the book. There it was, sitting on the porch, waiting to be useful. And she continuously is, she's headed left, but then someone needs her to go right, and she just does it. Mm-hmm. And I love that, even though, you know, being referred to as the hag or a witch or just a little girl, she's got a lot of negative influences in her life, but she continues to be so true to that loving nature. And like I said, in my world, you have to share these skills. You have to, everybody's better at different things, especially when we run like our long program, the 50-day program. I don't care about anyone's religion, race, sex, who they smooch. None of that matters. What matters is, did you get the firewood? Are you hurt? Are you cold? Can you make a fire? Are you way better at baking bread than anyone else? Could we encourage you to bake some bread? And it's just a beautiful book and a beautiful human being. I think we all need more Ellie's in our life. And less of the whatever that Mrs. Anderson or who I just, every time I've read
this book,
every time through, I just really want to push her off the mountain. She's just such a terrible person.
And I wanted to know, like, off the bat, is this a book about relationships? Like, instantly, that's what I got from the first chapter, is this is relationships? What's happening? This all feels kind of confusing because it starts so suddenly, like you were saying. And also, Hutch, do you think this could this have really happened? Is this what people, Amber, were really doing during the Depression? Did they lose their properties and they went into the woods? Where was the state coming in and saying, you don't own this property, you can't live here? Or were the laws different? That's what I found myself thinking, is we couldn't disappear to the woods and build a cabin on somebody else's property. There is no unowned property anymore, is there?
Or unclaimed, at least.
Yeah. Nowadays, it would be very hard, if for no other reason, you often show up to trailheads and they don't even post rules like they used to anymore. So I'm fortunate. I run around in Colorado and Wyoming and Montana a lot, which is where some of the first national parks, we have more of that than almost anyone, which unfortunately also means we have more regulation than almost anyone. I mean, as a teacher, I have to be very cognizant of this and what we can do.
Right.
As a kid growing up, so I grew up deep in the Medicine Bow Mountains, even when I was with my Cub Scouts, there were so many rules we broke, but it was because the information wasn't readily accessible. Nowadays, they actually will put on the trailhead, they'll put like a link to their rules, and they'll put, you're responsible to know, and it's pages, you know, 24 pages, 70 pages of stuff that they could technically write you on. Most of it, I think they'd be having a bad day. So there is that, some of the skills she's doing, some of the things she was doing. We have to remember, this is what, 1934. Right.
Yeah.
So things were a lot different. We had, let's see here, at the end of that, child labor laws were just drastically changing. Truancy laws were just, we see this also in My Side of the Mountain from book one to book two. Sam actually, as the world changes, so much of what he did to survive in the first book is people are starting to be like, well, you can't do that. They come, they take his bird away, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Right? With Ellie, I think nowadays, when Corona hit, I was getting phone calls from people I don't even remember knowing. And this became the question of, can you show us where to go get soap? And then the next question became, is it legal to just go get it from a park? Can you just go dig up? So the yucca root is antibacterial, wonderful soap. It's loaded with sapins. It has many other uses as well, but this root, and you can take, it's a very interesting plant in that if you only take half of the root and replant the other one, you haven't killed the tree. So here we have that sensitivity of Ellie again is, I'm not fighting nature. I'm working with nature. And is there a difference? But anyway, the big question there was, can we just go get some? And the short answer is no, that's actually illegal. You can't forage. You're not supposed to forage public lands. Can you talk to the trailhead guides? Would they allow stuff like that? That becomes a case-by-case basis. As a professional being recorded, I have to say no. But you take that case-by-case and do that. Back then, however, the laws were very, very different. And we actually did see, as a matter of fact, my three properties that I own for some of my classes, this is exactly what happened, is they were all mining claims. Very unsuccessful mining claims. I wish I had big mines. But there was a land baron. We see this with the stories of the robber barons. This is a common theme in a lot of the quickly made westerns and stuff, you know. But what they actually would do is there was sort of this, what is it they say? Possession is 9/10 of the law or something like this. And now I have no idea how much of this was legal. That's not my specialty. I just know what did happen. So in my case, what actually happened is this land baron came in and he basically took almost all of Cripple Creek. He just took it away from people. He could maintain it. They couldn't maintain it. He could afford to put a fence on it. They couldn't. And it became in this family's name for a very, very long time. And most of the land is completely unusable. That's why I was able to buy three properties way all these years later. But the weird thing is, because of the way that he took that land, in order for them to sell the land to me, they can't change a single thing about it. The way he doctored the paperwork and to make all that happen way, way back then, they had to sell me no road. It was just this portion, which survival instructor. I'm like, yes, that's great. Yes, that's great. But it made it very difficult to sell the land to other people. And this stuff is all just grandfathered in. Otherwise, the taxes would have killed the family nowadays. So it's what this was a thing that was happening. People would go in, obviously, you know,
and my squat, heritage, Cheyenne, essentially. And
well, more than just squatting. I mean, you know, ask any indigenous American in America. Basically, you just came, you know, to an area and you started working it, and that was your area, you know. So someone at some point in time, and we see this beautiful quotes from many of the characters, something along the lines of, we've been on this mountain since before your grandpa, and there were people before us, you know, kind of a thing.
Right.
So there's this kind of a weird scale there, because all of a sudden his name is escaping me, the main boy character. I can remember Samuel's name, but I can't think of, for the life of me. Help me out, guys.
With an L. I'm Larkin.
Larkin. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Larkin. Larkin is very funny, because there's almost this, not between him and Ellie, but between him and almost everyone else. And later on throughout the book, we kind of understand why. But this sort, there's sort of this, you took our mountain. And then later on, he makes a statement where, yeah, but we took it from somebody else. And that is kind of part of history, is there is always sort of this, for lack of a better word, public domain. And these kind of things did happen. And then I saw a lot of this during Corona. A lot of the properties around me actually sold, because people all of a sudden, they wanted to go back to these old ways, or they needed to go back to these old ways, or they didn't know what to do. Is, I hope none of your listeners hate me, but it was actually really good for business. It was a terrible event, but all of a sudden people had their eyes open to the fact that there were a lot of things like being able to can or make jerky or make glue or deal with toilet paper, find antibiotics. There were all these things that we've done for thousands of years, you know, that have just been forgotten, that have been lost. So we kind of saw that then, a lot of properties getting bought up. There's always that, there's so many weird laws, even nowadays. I had a neighbor who lost his property simply because he had allowed his neighbor to travel through it for however many years, 20 years or something. And the neighbor at some point in time had asked them, hey, could we just kind of do something to this road to make it easier to drive it up? Being neighborly, he said, yeah, sure. Well, this terrible person used that later on in court to say, well, I've upkept the road for 20 years. Mm-hmm. The cat was actually able to steal the property. So yeah. I guess it's a really long way to say, yes, this was happening. People were not just in this country, but other countries, people were going back to their gypsy roots. People were going back to their Nordic roots. They were having to get away because there's not as many resources in the city. And in the city, there were a lot of dangers. You know, we had obviously huge rises in, because, you know, when Prohibition comes around and we had all these other things going on, it was easy to run astray. So people had just enough of the skills then to say, you know what, I can barely remember my grandpa didn't need all these things. If we can just get back to the resources, which are in the mountains or on the farm or in the woods, I can just barely remember how to do that. It's a little scarier for people now because there's too many generations in between. But it was very common to do that there. You know, we've got people in Germany and Russia. Well, it wasn't Russia then, but we've got people all over the world burning their furniture because their lands had been so overforested. These classes are very, very hard to teach in England because, or Denmark, because there's like no trees in the few places that there are. They're so protected. Like there are a lot of countries you can't even just go camping. Like people don't realize how blessed we are by what they did with conservation and everything here, learning from their own mistakes. But when you're living in a town and you're burning your chair to stay warm, it's pretty easy to think, you know, maybe we should head out to the woods. And the other thing, we see this in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Obviously, there's always this question of why would Sam Gribble's parents just let him go out to the woods? Like, what terrible parents. But you have to remember the time period is all of these people, many people were having to send their kids away. You know, if you're not a reader, I'm not sure why you'd be on the podcast, or maybe you just want to supplement, but the story of Cinderella Man, you know, is a true story about a boxer who's, he starts, you know, he's fighting for his family, but his whole thing, what pushed him, he'd been a fighter, good fighter, but who was known for throwing fights and all kinds of stuff. He didn't really have the eye of the tiger, so to speak. He had the skill, but not really the will to really be a champion. But he reached a point where all the kids were being sent away. In the city, they couldn't maintain, they couldn't feed their kids, they couldn't keep them warm. So they were sending them away to the farms. They were sending them away to the other relatives, and he reaches this moment where he says, it is a book, by the way, Cinderella Man as well, so it's not one I would really recommend to get young readers interested, but a guilty pleasure in the bathtub or whatever. But anyway, he decides that he will fight for his family. He's got to make this money because he loves his kids so much. He doesn't want to see them sent away. Completely true story. And he becomes a heavyweight champion of the world. Well, not everyone had that ability. You know, I'd try that, just get my face knocked off. You know, so they did.
I think that's definitely what we see here is the dad's fight to keep the family together by bringing them out of town and into the base of the mountain. And then once the dad is in the coma, then it's the mother and children's fight to continue maintaining living while they're just in this limbo. It reminds me of the Dr. Seuss book, Oh, the Places You'll Go, where it's like, you know, and sometimes where he ends up in the place for waiting, right? Waiting for the tides to change, waiting for the wind to come, waiting for all these different things. And that's, and he's like, it's a terrible place to be, right? And it is a terrible place to be. And we feel that. We feel that uncertainty in their family where they can't plan. And that's a really hard place to be. They can't plan that the dad, what life will be if the dad gets better. And they can't plan what they would do without the dad ever getting better, because then that would be accepting that the dad is gone. And so they're in that season of waiting. And I think that that's adding to the discord even more than what they usually were having, with just the stress of having left the city and only half of them being happy about it.
Yeah, because they valued, the ones that are unhappy valued things that don't exist or they can't get their hands on anymore. But then there's this incredible value of what's being done out in the woods as a family that everybody's just kind of annoyed about. The ones that are unhappy there are kind of annoyed. Right. I found that kind of interesting.
I think that's how discontent works.
Yeah.
We see this a lot in, so I do a lot of stuff with search and rescue in the military and TV and other stuff. And we see this in both real search and rescue situations, real survival situations, new communities that pop up. But even just at our classes, two things. There's one in our rules of three. One of the first rules is you can't live for 3 seconds without hope. The second you start being negative, the second, so I always tell people, you know, identify the problems, but focus on solutions. That's our Ellie character. She's continuously saying, I did it because I had to. I would do it because I could. She's willing to learn. But then we have these other characters, her sister Esther, who, and we see this a lot with clients or just people in day-to-day life. they're so used to buying glue Mm-hmm. When glue ran out, there was no option. The idea of making glue wasn't there. They're so used to buying soap, you know. So we do see this a lot in people. They almost need, what is it Ellie says about Larkin? I was so glad to see he was a boy that didn't need to be told how to do everything. You know? Right? Sometimes we have a lot of people that are genuinely, they're either focused on the negative, so they kind of start giving up, or they just need the idea that it can't just be there. I was teaching a class a little while ago, and it was a navigation thing at the museum, and I had all these cool things hidden for them, and the kids were supposed to go get some clipboards and a pencil from my helper, and one of the kids wasn't listening, and they didn't get the clipboards. And everybody, this happened with a few people. A few of the kids were, you know, using each other's back to write. A few of the kids were using the wall. And then I had these two little boys that just had completely shut down. I don't have a clipboard. How am I possibly going to be able to write? So we see some of that. And then another thing that we see sometimes in people, I have to be very careful of this because I've been doing this so long. I'm really, really good at it. And one time I was at a certification and I was thriving. And one of the lead instructors for that school, they were going to employ me. I just had to go through the certification, prove I could do everything. He pulls me off the side. He says, "Hey, man." He says, "Just so you know, you got the job like weeks ago, but we need you to kind of get away from everyone because you're doing so good, it's bringing them down because they're struggling." And we see this in Ellie's family. Mm-hmm. It's almost like not only are they not really sure of, well, why would you do that? And they don't want to think outside the box. They've obviously got some prejudices there, but there is almost this resentment in, how dare you be making it? Like don't right. you know how unhappy we are right now? And how dare you be making it here? It's hard. We almost want to have everyone, what is it? Misery loves company, right? We want everyone to sit down and know that they're just as unhappy as we are with this thing that is so central to our life right now. And I think really
Ellie isn't just making it. Ellie's thriving.
Yeah.
This is what Ellie was made for. Yeah, she is coming into her own. She is blooming. And her sister, who is the oldest, who probably was a bit of a social butterfly back into the town, pretty dresses and all that, is now
not
a nobody who does not have pretty dresses and can't hack it outside the house and doesn't want to. And so she's just sitting in that miserable element. And you're right. Misery does love company. And a lot of times misery does not like having other people's joy right up in their faces.
So Hutch, can I ask you a question?
That was a question.
Okay, certainly, can I ask you?
Certainly, please, you can.
Okay, so how much of being really good at survivalism or being really good at these skills that you're teaching actually comes from the attitude of, like, I might make mistakes, but I'm going to keep going?
Everything. Okay. Everything. So I start every class. If you pick up a survival book and it doesn't have one of the first few chapters donated to the psychology of survival, you don't have a real expert. Put it down, save some money. You know, unless you're just learning, unless the book is entitled like "How to This Skill," nothing else, and you're just, you know, like I'm writing a book on hide glue. I'm not going to talk about the psychology of survival and that it's people are picking it up just because they want to make hide glue. That's different. But if you pick a book that's just supposed to be about primitive living, homesteading, survival, and it doesn't have a fair portion devoted to that, the rules of three, both the beginning.
What is that? You keep mentioning that. Can you?
I'm going to briefly, I'll get sidetracked if I'm not careful. So really briefly, I like to mention this in most classes, and I normally relate it to whatever book we're reading. We can do that as we go if you want. I would love to talk about the first minute and 40 seconds of this book if you'll give me that autistic 5 minutes and then you can cut me off or whatever. But the rules of three state, these sometimes get whittled down to just the romantic parts. But the full way that I learned it originally from Ron Hood is you have 3 seconds without hope. The second you start giving up, the second you start focusing on the negative, that's all you can see. They've done studies. If you focus on something for 17 seconds, it can change your entire day. 17 seconds of thinking you're mad at your husband or wife, or thinking that the car accident was bad, or thinking that teacher doesn't like you because you got a bad grade, can change everything in your day. So 3 seconds without hope. Okay. And this is quiet, right? I mean, quiet sets the entire stage for the book. We'll talk about that in a minute. After seconds, we move to minutes. You can live for 3 minutes without oxygen. This is very survival related, obviously, but it also does with hyperventilating. I can relate this to so many things, but moving through it briskly. After minutes comes hours. In extreme environments, you can live for 3 hours without shelter. If it's too hot, if it's too cold, if there's arrows falling from the sky, these would all be extreme environments where you need a shelter in order to live. And we see this in our characters many times. What was that? That was hours. After hours comes days. You can live for 3 days without water. Now, that is if you were going into it healthy and you're not working extremely hard, after about the first 24 hours, life gets pretty miserable. And we see all of these covered in the first minute and 40 seconds. It's a great book. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad she recommended it. What are we just on their days? After 3 days, we can live for 3 weeks without food. Now, I know every show you've ever seen, they've got them eating raw lizards right away, right? But it's because I do some technical advising for TV, and I'll never forget, I was actually working for, of all things, Bar Rescue at the time, because I was using some of these skills for a distillery to help them with their flavors and everything. And the person who had brought me in as an expert said to me, he said, one thing I want you to remember is in these type of shows, we sell commercials, not the show. Like, yes, there's education. Yes, there's drama. People love that. But what we really do is we sell commercials. Now, I won't give you the rest of that conversation because it really doesn't pertain to this, but there was some specific things he wanted me to do for that show. And that guidance has helped me with all of the TV things, because they, when you get someone to eat a lizard, it sells commercials. But there is no need for most, especially me. I got all this survival muscle because I love Oreo cookies. I can go way longer than 3 weeks, okay, without food. It's, and you never eat until you get water, because you have to use water to digest your food. Mm-hmm. But the first thing, and this is a mistake we see in even some of my favorite books, is our characters always go straight to food. But anyway, 3 weeks before we're even really, really worried about food. Obviously, things like the cold, injury, if you have a certain medical condition, all weigh into that. These are generalities. After weeks, we have months. 3 months without love, okay? Notice that number one, 3 seconds and 3 months, the two it's bookended, are both psychological based. Your mind is so important. If Ellie hadn't dunked that puppy, if she hadn't had that one moment of success, she's in a pretty negative environment with her sister blaming her and her mom not being sure about her. She's continuously bombarded. That girl, I believe, would have shut down if not for quiet. It's that success, that focusing on a solution, that lets her stand up to her mom, that causes her to walk up that mountain again and again. Now, we see that her mom is not all bad as the book goes on. She's actually, you know, quite supportive in some ways. But initially, it's kind of easy to dislike the sister and the mom, right? It's that hope that I did this and the puppy didn't die. I am going to fix my daddy. It's that hope that drives her on. There are numerous real situations all throughout history, but even in modern times right now, where people with skills don't survive, and where sometimes even small children, but people with no skills do. And what it comes down to as we study these things is their mentality, their hope, their positiveness, the psychology. If you identify the problem and focus on solutions, if you keep going, you find a way through, which we see our characters do numerous times here. That's great if you've got some training too. If you can have both the training and the positive attitude, that's great. But this is what we see on a lot of the TV shows, is the second the person starts getting negative up here in the brain, their producer, because each character has a producer assigned to them and their technical advisor, they already know what's happening. So they already start trying to think how to spin the articles and what's going on. We see this with students too. If I can sit down and offer you a piece of gum, and if I can get you to identify why you were cold and start looking at solutions, you'll make it through the 50 days. If all I can get you to do is continue to complain about how, like, if no matter what I try, you just keep telling me how miserable it is, how cold you are, how there's nothing I can do to bring you back. Even if I have offered to put my camp right next to someone, I'll sleep next to the fire with you tonight. But if they've already given up in their brain, there's nothing I can do to bring them back. Even when I start getting them warm, they'll think they're cold. Versus I have other students that it's like, this is a really miserable class. I'm considering, you know, giving them a half off discount or something, but they're so positive. They're just like, what else you got, Hutch? This is great. Or, oh, I'm warm. I'm doing good. I'm making stuff. I'm carving spoons. Yeah, that part over there, that stunk a little bit, but da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I could go on for hours, so I'll stop myself there. To answer your question, most important skill is the ability to think positive. I would argue of the very second most important skill is the ability to be creative, to look at things and be like, I don't know, maybe that's a chair. Let's see if it's a chair. I need a chair.
Yeah.
Sorry if that was too long.
You're fine. My eldest and I are listening through The Lord of the Rings right now. And so last night we're listening to The Two Towers, and what you're saying about like hope and mindset is so funny, because if we take out food from the equation, like food is what the Hobbit's hope was, right? Like not as nourishment as much as comfort.
Oh, yeah.
And feeling like they were being nourished emotionally. And so we were at the scene where Pippin and Merry are finally starting to get free from the orcs. There's like that chaotic battle going on around them. The only nourishment that they have had on this 3-day forced walk has been the orc tonic that they don't even know what was in that fire brandy. And so here they are. They've gotten free. Like the orc that wanted to kill them has just died and they're sitting there and they have not even gotten out of the middle of the battle. And they're like, do you still have your elf bread? Yes, I have my elf bread. Let's eat some. And so like they eat the elf bread and like that rejuvenates them. Yeah. It gives like that centers their hope. Like we're no longer hungry. We're no longer feeling like we aren't okay because we, you know, the elves represent hope for them. Like that was, it put them back in this like good mindset of safety and protection. And then they were able to get away. But I'm just like, they're like, I was just sitting there laughing because they're sitting in the middle of this chaos battle having a picnic. Like that's basically what it comes down to. Like their immediate danger had passed in their mind. The immediate danger of the person holding the knife up to them has passed. They're sitting there in the relative seclusion of their little elf cloaks. So nobody is seeing them. And they're just having a picnic in the middle of like sheer chaos. And that's what hope is. Like hope is like, we're just going to be happy here. No matter what's going on, it's going to be okay.
In anything you can do, you see this, we used to see this in Afghanistan and stuff. It was common for a sergeant to give a menial task to someone, clean your rifle. Okay. It's a skill this person knows how to do. They do it. It gets them thinking positive. It's something they can do. But cooking, now I mentioned you don't need food right away. I have a book. This one's not self-published. This one is for a Dropstone Presses, but it's one of the things I've noticed really endears me to my students is I grew up, you guys have heard the other podcast, but for anyone that didn't hear that, very basically, the way I grew up was very, very different. It was very old school. I grew up around the reservations, deep, deep in the mountains with this wonderful but eccentric mountain man who lived with the old ways, and he used these skills to help me with my autism. There weren't coping mechanisms back then or books on it, you know, and so that's the short version. I grew up very, very differently, and what I found endears me to students is it's not always
that throw in that the old mountain man was also your grandfather.
Yes, he was, yes. And this old, you know, Cheyenne Lakota man, and just amazing. And the people he put me around, you know, it changed my life. But when my students see that, oftentimes they come to me because they want to learn that thing that we did with that guy on that TV show or in this book. And they learn it. You know, I think I'm a pretty good teacher. But the thing that gets them coming back and really pulls them off to the side is when they see me wake up in the morning and, you know, they've got their ramen noodles or their labels. They've got their dehydrated meal, you know, and they're not bad, but they're kind of like, okay, this is great. And they watch me make nutritious, fresh baked donuts using a log and some fresh coffee to it. And I go and, you know, collect some fresh honey. And they're just like, that right there. We'll get back to this Bojo thing, but that thing, what did you just do? So there is something to be said for the morale of food. Like when I have a student that I'm losing them, especially if I do teach for some certification programs, especially with the military and search and rescue. And I take it as a bit of a personal insult when I lose a student. I think there's something more I could have done. And I have to be very careful because in these washout programs, that is part of the program. You know, they want them to do it. And I'm very blessed that most of the big schools I represent, they know me and they have my back and they don't. But one of the things, a moment that can make or break someone, much like with our hobbits. Of course, this is a culture, the hobbits, you know, they've got first breakfast and second breakfast and onesies and noons. Food is a very big part of their culture, right? If you can sit down, if you have someone that's a musician, food is many things. Food is not just what goes in our belly. If you've got someone who is a musician, food for their soul. If you can get them to sing you a song or play a harmonica, you can bring them back. If you get someone that is a foodie, you sit down and you even just offer them a stick of gum while you're talking, or you bake a little bit of bread. It brings them psychologically to a place. We're not talking about the rules of three or the nourishment. We're right back to that hope. But the thing is, the trick is you have to find out what that food is. It could be talking about their kids. It could be discussing books. It could be carving a spoon. Alexander the Great used to actually force all of his soldiers before a battle to carve something for someone back home. And this was a really big deal, especially if you look like the Celts. That's part of my heritage. You were required to carve a spoon for a young lady you were proposing to, and you had to present that to her family. This allowed them to look at the spoon and, number one, say, is there any skill here? Is this an artisan that can provide? But number two, they could look at that spoon and they could say, how much thought did he put into this? This spoon looks like it was thrown together pretty quick. This is a lustful spoon. Or they could look at the spoon and be like, this spoon is several months long. It's got, and some of these spoons, if you see them in museums, are intricate. You know, so much thought, so much time, and you're sitting there carving. Well, Alexander wanted his warriors, before going into a battle, having all these positive thoughts. Not if I get home. When I get home, I'm proposing with this spoon. I'm giving this horse to my son. I'm giving this to my mom. And so he's got all of his soldiers. You can't carve in the dark. So now all the soldiers have come together as a community. We need that as human beings. Every day I'm on YouTube, yeah, and I see at least one person that can't wait to get on Facebook, can't wait to get on Facebook to tell me how they're a loner and they don't need people and they don't like Facebook. But they felt the need to post about it, right? People walk up to me all the time, oh, I'm such a loner, but you needed to tell me that, didn't you? So we've got our troops around the fire, interacting, being positive, talking about that girl back home, that son back home, the amazing whatever porridge that they're going to make with this spoon. They're super positive. They're not thinking for a second they're not going to make it through this battle. When I get done with this battle, I'm going to go do this thing. And as a wonderful side note, the metal was not particularly wonderful at that time period. You can't carve with dull swords. So it also had them sharpening their weapons. That's something that most soldiers dislike doing greatly. So,
in the parenting world, we would call that currency. Find your kids' currency, what they're just going to want to talk about and get really like bright-eyed about.
I love that. Find their currency.
Yeah, you can kind of draw them back from whatever ledge they have themselves on to be like, hey, tell me about that. And let's talk about that a little bit.
I love that.
Okay, I want to hear your minute 46. Is that what you said?
I will be as brief as I can. So just a couple of things that happen for me. When I'm with my books, reading is a huge part of my family's culture. Even when I'm teaching long classes, fortunately, I'm skilled enough. I don't have to sign contracts or anything. People just let me work for them. But part of the deal we talk about is I'm here for the students day or night. I'll teach all night long. But at 7 o'clock, my time, mountain time, I stop and I go and I either read to my kids or I tell them stories over the phone. So I look at books very differently. I'm constantly making notes in books. Oh, next time I read this to Scout, what are we going to talk about in this line? Oh, what amazing lesson is here? Da, 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 da. And I'm using them continuously to reference, right? So in my first, this is not counting the intro. When I timed this, I wasn't reading the intro. So not counting the intro, the first minute and 41 seconds of this book, this is what I see. All right. Very first thing, lady's name is Lauren Wolk. It's dedicated to her sons. That's very interesting to me on so many levels, right? I already told you, so I start going down this romantic path of who is this lady and why did she write the book? And I will very rarely research an author before I read their book because I had this series. This is an adult series. It's called The Sword of Truth, Terry Goodkind. Wonderful series. Be slightly cautious with it if you're currently struggling with temptations of, you know, the flesh and stuff like that. But wonderful, wonderful series for adults. Wouldn't get out. But it's about this woodsman that becomes a wizard. How could I not love this book, right? It's a series. One of the books I read in the entire day, sitting in the bathtub till my feet were blue. But then later on, years later, I was at this literacy conference teaching some of my skills. And I had the pleasure of meeting the man, and a lot of his own personal politics came out, which was really odd because these are some of my favorite book series. But when I would reread the books, I went from loving them to liking them because all of a sudden I could continuously see these agendas popping up. I was like, how did I never notice this before? So I never researched them beforehand. So I've got this beautiful image of who was this lady? How did she know this? Same thing with the female who wrote My Side of the Mountain. A lot of people don't know that was a female author because she described everything. Things from Sam's perspective, and it's just like, yes, this is what it's like to be a little boy. What an amazing author. But I'm always so curious about why did they do this? What did they ever run away from home? Did they try? So there's that. It's May 1934. Right away, my first thought is, oh, what a great way to, now I can talk to the kids about what was going on around this time period, all these things that to our kids, the Great Depression resonates way more to our Corona kids than it does to a lot of us growing up in the 70s and the 80s, right? I mean, because we didn't, for them, this whole idea of we can't just go to the store all the time, it's a bit newer to them, right? So right away, I'm trying to think, okay, before I read this, I have to explain to my kids what was going on in the time period, what da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then we get into the actual book, right? Just initially, we just get in there, and the very first thing that happens is this puppy is dead. We think. right? Mm-hmm. Now, before I go any further, can you tell me which of the rules of three is about to come into play? Now, I know I'm putting you on the spot. You just heard it the first time. I'll give you a clue. It's one of the first couple ones.
Oxygen,
right? So every breathing animal on this planet has a reflex in their reptile brain that if at the last moment before they kick it, you know, if you're choking someone at the last moment, they will try and gasp for breath. If they're underwater at the last moment, and it's this 3 minutes without oxygen that comes into play. So here we've got this little girl that's been sent to bury a puppy. And so much happens in two sentences, right? The mom says, make sure to bury her far beyond the well. Why? That's their only water source, that well. They've mm-hmm. had to dig, which is really hard work in my neck of the woods because of rocks. I don't know much about Maine. Digging a well, you have to get below the water table. This is a right. lot of work, okay?
Yeah.
If they bury this dog in the wrong place, not only in my neck of the woods does it bring in predators, but more importantly, because predators are food, coyote's not bad as long as you get off all the hair off of it. One piece of hair and that coyote tastes just like wet dog smells. But otherwise, it's not bad. If they contaminate their water, this can kill, and mm-hmm. this literally has killed mm-hmm. entire yeah. civilizations, right? We do look all throughout history. You yeah. lose the water, you lose life. So just, and it's just kind of an offhand little detail that makes me even more curious about the author. You know, the little details that she wiggled in without too much explanation. What did she know? What had she done? Are we kindred spirits? So make sure to bury it far beyond the well. We don't want to pollute the water. We want to bring anything in, right? So then we've got that rule of three. Then the oxygen rule of three comes into play. She looks at this bucket, this item, just waiting to be useful. Okay. Mm-hmm. And how scary must have this have been for her mother, who's watching, to see this slightly sociopathic behavior, right? She looks like she's drowned in a dead puppy, right? Right. But bells are going off. It's a little scary. But she's got this gut instinct, this intuitive instinct, something she has seen, some experiential learning. At some point in time, she has seen, and later on, we learn her why. She explains the why later on. We don't know it here, you know, but later on, she won't tell Samuel or anyone else, but she explains to Larkin why she did this, what her experience was, but we just have to take it for granted at this point in time. Some life experience, she's seen something gasp for air, and she plunges this puppy in the thing, in the water, and it gasps for air, and it comes back for life, and this sets the pace for the entire book. We now have a little girl that just learned, just like a dog, one-to-one ratio, I sit, I get treat, I sit, I get treat. I mm-hmm. trust my instincts, mm-hmm. I am mm-hmm. useful. Mm-hmm. Something amazing yeah. happened here, right? There's so much other stuff we don't see. While this is going on, when she turns around to her poor, terrified mother, what is her mom doing? Subtle one-sentence thing. She's holding the bloody straw to get rid of it. We can't invite the predators into our house where we sleep, right? Or into where the puppies are. Mm-hmm. That's a huge right. problem. But this just paves the way for not only why would Ellie continue to be, for lack of a better word, stubborn when she needs to be stubborn. You know, when mm-hmm. she bends a lot of the time, this kid puts up with a lot. But there are moments where when her intuitive healing kicks in, when she just knows what to do. And then there's little details. So in the Marine Corps, I was K-9. The heartbeat name, what she calls a heartbeat name. Most of the best dog trainers in the world, the Marine Corps sent me all kinds of cool places. Very expensive, I'm sure, to train. A dog's name should have two syllables. A heartbeat name, bump, bump, like Ellie talks about. We won't go too far down that. We can talk about this with Call of the Wild or something in the future. Quiet's name has a hard T at the end. Quiet. Dogs need that. They need that hard syllable to pick up on. But heartbeat names are actually very important. I've never heard them called that before. But the two-syllable name, we can talk about that later. We see them doing all kinds of chores. You just have to get through day-to-day life. No one else is going to collect the firewood.
Right.
No one else is going to deal with these things. You know, if all the only cloth you have is the sleeves from this beautiful shirt your father made you, but you have to dress a wound, you dress the wound. You mm-hmm. figure out a way to fix it later.
Right.
You make a new shirt. She's just continuously looking for solutions. But I do firmly believe that without quiet, what I wrote down in my notes is make sure to mention 3 seconds without hope. We did that. But I firmly believe that without the success of quiet, we've got this sister who's constantly tearing her down and has everyone convinced it's Ellie's fault that her father may die. We've got a mother who, you know, she's not really sure what to think of her daughter. Both these people are negative places. Now, it is arguable she's got Samuel, who's very eager to learn from her. She has replaced dad for Samuel in some ways. Not really replaced, but she's filling in for, mm-hmm. you know. So that might have pulled her through. But I don't think in the real world, I think Ellie could have been real. I get asked this all the time. Was Sam Gribble real? Yeah. Could this have happened? I think Ellie could have been real. I think the book could have been real. So many of these heritage skills are still used, especially in Appalachia, the Deep Rockies, or on reservations. A lot of real skills in this book, but it all comes down to quiet and the 3 seconds without hope. And that little puppy, even when she thinks she's going to lose the puppy, but that win sets the stage for every other success in the book.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think it really sets her. Yeah, that's great. I think it sets her self-confidence. Like she is able to trust herself. And I think that she has confidence in the decision that she made that saved Samuel in the first place. That and she's also confident that like she knows she doesn't want to hurt other people mm-hmm. by telling that full story. And so she's in this full protector mode, and you used the word stubborn, and I feel like it's an applicable word. She does come off as stubborn, but I think that that has so many negative connotations attached to it. Like people are like, oh, there's a stubborn kid that's not just obeying everything that her mother tells her to do. But I really see her as a steadfast character. She is resolutely and dutifully firm and unwavering in what she knows is right. Like, she may not know exactly how to do it, like how she's trying out different things on her dad to help heal him, but she knows not giving up is the right thing to do and that giving up is the wrong thing to do. And with the old woman on the mountain, like she doesn't know exactly what to do, but she knows that helping is the right thing and abandoning her is the wrong thing. And she's constantly willing to follow the path to rightness, regardless of who it's upsetting to,
which I think is her own detriment too. I mean, that I don't think I'm strong. There's so many times when reading this book where I just want her to turn around and scream at Esther, "It wasn't me, it was you," you know? And for me is there's a genuine strength to this character too. Mm-hmm. I mean, and of course we don't see that we know, but her father at the very, you know, the last couple chapters when he looks her in the eye and he says, "I didn't forget anything." They never mention it to anyone else. And she protects so many people with that lie, and she puts up with so much. She's an amazing heroine. Yeah. I definitely like steadfast better than stubborn. Cause I mean, it is, she's not being negative. Now her mom might know that. I mean, if the story was written completely from the mom's perspective or Esther's perspective, it wouldn't be until almost the last couple chapters that it became a positive book. I mean, we would have this, you know, right. Which is a great thing to kind of point out. As a matter of fact, my son and I were just talking about this morning because I was reading out loud to him the portion where I was rereading because I'd made the notes. He's having a little bit of trouble with this kid at school, and it was just so applicable to our day-to-day thing. When Esther realizes who the crone is, it changes everything for her. And Ellie says to her, "Why would that have mattered? It doesn't matter if she's the crone or Kate or Miss," I forget what her actual last name is. And then later on in the book, the mom continues to refer to her as the last name rather than Kate, because she's willing to make all these sacrifices for the nurse, almost as if the crone who's been living on the mountain is a whole other person, you know, as if, and part of that is probably to make them feel better about their attitude and the way they treated some people throughout the books. But then we've got Ellie, who puts up with all of this in order to protect the people who are subjecting her to it. You know, and I just think, I don't know that I'm that strong. I'm just so proud of her. And, it's easy to love this character and want to protect. As a dad, I want to just rush in and be like, "You stop being so mean to this little girl." But it's just a phenomenal strength.
Yeah. The old crone on the mountain aspect definitely made me think of we should be careful how we treat people, because you never know when you're entertaining an angel unawares.
Exactly.
Like, just because they didn't know who she was, they were willing to treat her a certain way. But it's like, you don't know who she is. Like, and everybody has value. And so they should have been treating her well because it was the right thing to do, which is what Ellie was doing, because there was someone who had a need that they could meet. But the medicine that they use on her is very interesting. You said that you're writing a book on the uses for hide.
Yeah.
And Ellie ends up making that like hide dam to hold the glue to hold the medicine in. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So this, so I write, one day I'll write big books and hopefully fiction books. I've been pretending to be a writer since before I could write words. I would just scribble and then I'd have to go tell my grandpa what I wrote, you know, because he took me on these great adventures and I got to meet lots of people, and a lot of them were writers or they were on National Geographic or whatever. So it's been a dream my whole life. Right now, what I mostly write is how-to books because my field is very skill oriented, you know. And one of the things that I specialize in is heritage and indigenous skills. I've got to live with people around the world, and people underestimate how strong some of these skills were. What I'm writing about is hide glue. You can devote an entire animal to hide glue if you are a luthier, as in this book. So we see Kate. Well, we hear a story about Kate giving the hides of animals that she doesn't need to her son so that he can make these beautiful instruments. So you can use the whole animal, or it can be made out of just the leftover, the hooves, the eyeball, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's crazy strong. It has been used all throughout history for so many things, to repair ships, to make chairs. That skill I like to teach is a chair, especially with me being, I'm overweight, you know, sometimes a fair bit overweight. And when it can support me and my kids, this chair, people really start realizing, wow, these old skills work. Or my great grandma should have had a doctorate in microbiology. I can't believe she could do these things. It has a few weaknesses. It needs to be used on organic materials to be really, really strong. You can, if you want to separate the seam, you can do it with water or heat, but it's been used on making musical instruments, healing people, obviously all these beautiful crafts, things like, sinew back bows and dream catchers, but it'll also suspend shelves, and it's been stuff in the book. We see it used. It's used by Larkin's dad to make instruments. Very, very, very powerful glue for that kind of thing. Some of the best instruments in the world still today are made using the old ways. Even jewelry. There's a skill I teach called the pump drill, and really, really expensive jewelry from Israel, Jewish jewelry, which is quite expensive. They still use little pump drills to settle all the stones and stuff, because it gives a quality that you just can't get. So that the hide glue, what it is you can boil down parts of the animal, and what holds us together, the proteins at the bonds, we can essentially make, I often refer to it as a tea, but I think I'm going to switch it to brew because I like the way Ellie words it. I think I'm going to change the parts of my book that are already written to brew. It makes me feel very Merlin-esque, which I like. I'm starting to go gray, which I'm thrilled about because now I've got the Dumbledore thing going on, you know. So I asked my grandfather one time, all the kids were making me be the Lone Ranger. And I always wanted to be Tonto. I said, Grandpa, am I an Indian like you? And he said to me, he said, son, he said, you've got just enough Indian in you. You'll never grow a beard, but not enough that you won't go bald. So I don't really know what that means. But anyway, I'll never have the beard, but I've got the gray coming in now. So I'm very proud about that. Total tangent. Squirrel, there it went. This glue, you boil it down, you make this brew, and then you continue to boil it until the consistency changes. Very, very easy to do. And you can actually dry it out completely. To where it won't go bad. It can be used year round, all kinds of stuff. And once you reconstitute it, you do have to pay attention because it can go bad. And you know when it goes bad. As a matter of fact, when our male character, when Larkin goes to find his grandmother after her son has died, he describes the house as smelling rancid because the glue has gone bad. Just one very brief line that once again makes me wonder, this author, is she just an amazing researcher? Or where did she grow up? What did she know? How cool was her grandma? You know, is the author still alive? And can we have some tea sometime? What does she know that I don't know yet about these skills? That's a very subtle detail that only someone who's ever made the glue and accidentally let it go bad, you never forget. You never forget that smell, boy howdy. Anyway, it's a very, very strong glue.
Can the glue be made from any hide?
Yes.
Of any animal, or is it a certain animal?
No, any hide. Believe it or not, it can even be made from fish skin. Now, we normally recommend, in my world, fish skin is too valuable for the nutrients that you need that are hard to find, especially at certain times of the year. It's better to eat the skin. It can also be made from the eyeball, but again, eyeballs are filled with electrolytes. So, I mean, if you got to pick between, if your raft is sinking, the immediate need is to glue the raft, right? But if you're just trying to repair some items of the raft that aren't essential, and you are dying because you're out in the ocean, your sun, remember I teach all aspects of survival, not just camping survival, you're better off sucking those eyeballs out of the fish and eating the skin assuming you have water. Otherwise, there's actually a pure bit of water down the back of a fish you can suck out, but you have to worry about mercury and stuff. Anyway, any hide can be used. Believe it or not,
You're not worried about mercury, right?
Right. So the hide of any animal, to include fish, there's a few things you do have to worry about. I'm going to have a little amendment chapter in my book. It will never dry completely, so it's kind of a quick use thing. Also, it's probably more beneficial to eat the skin. You can also make fish leather. They make beautiful sheaths and stuff. You can use the eyeballs. You can use the tendons and the sinew itself, but that's so much better to be saved for cordage. The hooves can also be used. The whole thing about horses being in glue. Yeah, you can absolutely, hooves make good glue, but you can do it with the hair on or the hair off. All of these things change your glue. They also change the process. Hair off, when you're making buckskin, it's a lot of work. So if you just need a little bit of glue for a quick thing, don't go through all that process. However, if you're going to use the glue for long periods of time, Larkin's dad, for example, would have taken the time, because having hair in these beautiful instruments that he's making, people came from all over that neck of the woods to buy these. Nobody wants to see a little bit of rabbit hair stuck to the side of their thing. So it depends on your uses, and different temperatures affect it. But yeah, in any hide and numerous other parts of the animal, not our meaty portions, but it's the collagen and the proteins. They get into this brew, and it's basically the things that allow our own skin to mend. Okay, I'm not talking about the clotting factors, although yes, there is some in blood as well, but I'm talking about more how the skin mends, basically the natural things that our skin does that make it neosporiny, if you will. We can use that. My world is all about observation and physics. Like it's so amazing, especially because of the way our ancestors are so often depicted, but it's amazing all the things that they knew and could do. They just didn't have the words, you know, but every one of you guys has a lot of doctorates in your background. You just might not realize everything great grandma was doing. You
know? Yeah, that's all so interesting. Thank you so much for sharing all of this with us. I think that it's really fun to look at a book and say, besides just what I learned from the story, because like Val started with, I really felt with the first time I read this is an emotion book. Like this is a relationship book. Absolutely. This is one of those books as a female that I look forward to reading to at different stages in my life, because there's some very good female characters at different ages of development and experience in this book that I know I'll relate to differently as I continue aging and having more life experiences. And I'm excited that my daughters get to read it when they're younger at Ellie's age, so they can read it at different stages growing too. But then there's just, like you said, I was like listening to Inara read My Side of the Mountain. We listened to that on the audiobook with Gemma last year. And I was like, I think Echo Mountain's like the girl version of that. Like I've read a lot of books, and I really think it's the closest one with a female lead from the books that I've read that really truly gets into the nitty gritty of all the survival aspects.
Well, and it's more than even survival. They're both heritage skills books, because neither of our characters, well, arguably they are both in several survival situations in both book, you know, both characters. I mean, we could have an entire podcast on just the compare and contrast of the two, but I think what makes that statement incredibly true, several things. First off, as a dad, I read this and I'm continuously noticing how Samuel's learning and what's going on. I'm just like, there are a lot of parenting tips in this book. Like, you know, so yeah, so many emotions, so many connections, so many, boy, I hope I never do that. Or I need to watch my words, because we can see inside of Ellie's brain and how these things are affecting her, right? Very cool. But I think what makes the books a great comparison is they are either both very, very well researched. Well, either way you look at it, they're very, very well researched. It was either well researched through the author did these things, or the author spent a lot of time interviewing and observing these things. I'm often asked, "It was Sam Gribble real?" You know, because the author made that very cryptic statement of, because people were going out to the Catskills to try and find him, and you know, so she makes the statement of, "I need you to stop doing this, stop running away from home. Sam Gribble wasn't real, and if he was." I would certainly keep a secret. And it's like, well, but then, why'd you have to add that last part? Like, is he real? But one of the things about it is there's all these little subtle details that make you believe that if the writer didn't go through some of these things, Hatchet is a phenomenal book. It's got a supplemental book to it. I had never even heard of this book until I met Gary Paulson. I actually showed him Bojo, you know, he was kind of, I think, creeped out because my wife is like, oh yeah, my husband knows these things. And I'm sure Gary Paulson hears that all the time. He's like, oh, I'd love to see it all the time. And she's like, oh, wait. And I'm like breaking chairs. He's like, oh God, this guy's really going to do this. Poor man, right? I kind of had a hero worship thing. It got out of autistic control there. But anyway, he's probably hired security because of me. But he gave me a book recommendation. He had it. I bought it. He wrote another book called, I believe it's called Guts. I'd have to run down and check it. You guys know I'm terrible about, I always mispronounce authors' names and give the title slightly wrong, so we can look this up for the listeners. But it's not a standalone book as his best writing, because Paulson is so good about making believable characters. This book is a little bit more, it's just short stories that are all the true stories from his life that made his writing so good. And it's fascinating to see, well, why did this character in this book do that? Did that? I would love for the author of My Side in the Mountain or Echo Mountain to have had something similar, because these books, there are so many people trying to write books like this, and these two books have such a sense of trueness to them, such a sense of you could be there with the character, that there are occasional moments where I'm like, okay, that's so wrong. Ellie couldn't have been real, or that's so wrong. Sam could have been real. But then you also have to ask yourself, have I never made mistakes in my day-to-day life? For 46 years I've been doing this, right? Have I never had an opinion that changed over years? So, but then there's so many things that are so right and so subtle. It's easy to believe that the author lived both of those books, and it makes them a wonderful comparison. Like I said, they both have survival moments, but they're more than a survival book, because there's the psychology, there's the connections in both books. You know, Sam needs Bandit. Yeah. Sam needs the librarian. Ellie certainly needs quiet. She certainly needs her little brother. And she doesn't realize it, but she needed Larkin and Kate, you know, and everything. This becomes a happy story because of the connections people overcome, because of the connections that are made. So there's the skills, there's the heritage living, there's this amazing true connection to history. And they are, I think it's a wonderful comparison. And as I mentioned, for me, I'm very picky. When a teacher approaches me and says, can you come teach some skills from this book? The answer is always yes. Yeah, you picked the book. And my question is always, what is it you were hoping to get from this book, or a parent or a book club? When someone approaches me and says, I've heard about your literacy outreach program, can you just bring it? I'm very, very picky what books go in there. And they have to bring more than just a survival story or just a justification for me teaching Flint and Steel to someone. And this book, if I had a friend one time, because I love books, I have a problem with books. And he asked me for a review. And he said, what I want you to do is imagine you were only allowed 12 inches on a bookshelf. Your wife has said, no more survival books. We're getting rid of all of them. What books would you put in those 12 inches? For my literacy program, My Side of the Mountain and Echo Mountain are definitely in those 12 inches. I'd put them in 6 inches. Because there's almost too much going on to talk about in one sitting, because you have to focus on just one aspect of it. Just teach the skills, or just talk about the psychology. I'd have loved to meet this author. I really would.
Well, she is still alive, and she's written other books. Wolf Hollow was a Newbery winner, and then Beyond the Bright Sea. And Wolf Hollow just had a sequel written last year, My Own Lightning. But Amanda loves all of her books. I've only read Echo Mountain because Amanda's convinced that I'm going to love, I think, Beyond the Bright Sea even more than Echo Mountain. And I can't believe it yet. Yeah. And so I haven't read it yet. But
well, sometimes it's hard. When you're in an author's brain cave, sometimes it's hard to, one of my favorite authors, we talked, I think we might've had to cut this because I went on too long a tangent, but in the last podcast we did, I went on like an Edgar Rice Burroughs tirade, right? About Tarzan and how much it means to me and what a great, you know, series it was or anything. But the funny thing is, I love being in that man's brain cave. And some of the Tarzans are bad. Tarzan and the Ant Men, for example. You know, it's like, oh my goodness, what's happening here? But I can't read anything else by Burroughs. I can't read the John Carpenter adventures because the voice is so close, but it's just the wrong angle for me. So I get that. It's like, I would have a hard time. This book's almost too good to follow it up. Like it's almost, for me, to pick up that book and not hear John Clayton's voice or Ellie's voice, or with My Side of the Mountain, it's a series of three books. I love the first two, but the third book is all from Frightful's perspective, and the voice is too different. Mm-hmm. I just can't dig into it. So many people recommend books to me that are supposed to be good as My Side of the Mountain, and so many of them just aren't. I don't want to mention any examples here because I don't want to ruin anything. Yeah. And how dare you take any adventure away from an adventure. But when you guys first recommended the book, I gave my typical smile and nod. It's kind of like when someone wants to know if I know Bear Grylls or blah, blah, blah. You know, you smile and you're polite, you know, are you Crocodile Dundee, whatever. I was kind of forced to read the book for you guys, you know, because it is hard to find a book that puts me in the same state as my mini relationship. Sam Gribble, that book changed my life. God bless the librarian. If she was still alive, I would have her listen to this podcast. I can't thank her enough. She put that book in my hands after running to the card catalog to look up all these weird skills. You know, this is my autistic obsession. I do like trains. I know everybody always thinks it should be trains. Why wouldn't anyone like trains? I don't understand. But the thing I have to be careful talking about is books, and specifically books about heritage skills, indigenous skills, survival skills. This is where I lose people and become the negative connotation sometimes with autism. Some students love it, some don't. So when someone recommends one of these books for me, especially one that's supposed to be as good as my very best friend on the face of the planet that has guided me through so many situations, mm-hmm. and has paved the way for a life that provides for my family and has fulfilled my dreams, I'm very hesitant. But fortunately, yeah. It was followed up with a sentence of, we'd really like to read you to read this book so we can talk about it in a podcast. And God bless you for doing that, because it's a great book. It's a great book that I probably wouldn't have read otherwise. And it far exceeded my expectations on so many levels.
Good. Well, I'm so glad. And we do appreciate you being willing to read it and come back and discuss it with you. Or discuss it with us, and us discuss it with you. We really,
for anyone that hasn't read this book yet, or who wants to revisit this book. So in preparing for this podcast, I got notes to try and keep me on track. We're going to use them when you need them, because otherwise this will be 24 hours. But a combination of this and this thing I've started doing, it's this program where I try and bring books to life, not just survival books, but anything out. Show how the Hobbit would have made his food, or what would they have done on that boat with Jaws, or anything from my world. Even I just did it with A Christmas Carol over Christmas, where I just showed the heritage skills that Scrooge would have been doing, like lighting the coal, right? And as I'm taking the notes, I always have trouble creating content. And I started realizing, you know, there's something here. And we had talked about me maybe reading a Green Ember and doing something similar like this. So the idea was sparked there, and then taking these notes. I think what I'm going to do, if nothing else, just as a legacy to leave for my kids, or to keep my brain on track so when they get older, I can use these things. Like there's certain books I always read if I'm getting ready to go with a certain group of people, like try and put me in the mindset of an angry teenage boy, you know, or whatever. Right. I can't stand The Catcher in the Rye, but I always read it before this certain group that I work with, because it's some troubled kids and I need to remember what it was like to be there. It's a great book. I don't mean to, but the book just puts me in a weird place. Yeah. Just like, you know, he's a very angry character. I kind of want to go through each chapter. Now it's going to be loaded with spoilers, and make a short maybe YouTube mm-hmm. video and explain some of the skills. And with this and My Side of the Mountain and a few other books I can think about, and we'll see if people like them. Maybe I'm just doing this for myself. But I really kind of want to go through each thing and as if it was a book club. And be like, here's what,
right.
from my world, here's what I saw in this chapter. Mm-hmm. And are you curious how this skill would have worked? Like here, this is actually how I make all of my leather. It's at this. So those of you that are driving down your car, you're missing that. We'll cut this out. you're missing. It's like when a comedian gives you the visual reference.
Add a picture to the show notes for people.
So this is a piece of wood. This is an old bow drill spindle. It's the name that was given to me many years ago, Uzla de Diachila, which I am not Cherokee, but it's a Cherokee name. It roughly means one whose fortune is bound in fire, or lucky fire. That's a story for another day. But I do a lot of fire skills because it's what I'm known for. This is just an old piece of wood that was bow drill. And you're barely going to see it, but this incredibly hard substance here is hide glue. Holding in a piece of bone that I sharpened on a rock. I've been using this since I was about 12 years old. This is how I make almost all my leather gear. This sharp bone is getting smaller now. It's getting worn out, kind of like how Ellie's flint does. I poke it through. It's a primitive sewing machine. It works exactly the same technology. I poke it through to make a hole. Then I hook on the cordage. and I pull it back through, and then I move the cordage down and poke another hole. It's how like speedy stitches work. Same thing. Mm-hmm. This goes with that. Here's a little knife made from a bone. Same thing. Hide glue holding it all together. Years it's held this together. If I don't submerge it in water, get it too close to the fire, and you can see that knife blade is not, I mean, it's not wiggly. It's better made than a lot of knives you get from the store, right? I don't have any idea why I was showing you those. Was I going to say something? I grabbed a bunch
of random. You're talking about wanting to make YouTube videos about chapter by chapter.
I just think it'd be really cool as you're going into this book, especially if you're a family that doesn't do a lot with heritage skills or outdoor skills, if you had a reference that you could go to right before each chapter and just like a quick little 5-minute thing and be like, so for some reason, you know, try and leave the spoilers too much out of it. You know, the Great Depression is going to be talked a little bit about, or, you know, explaining to my kids the stock market crash. And about the best description I've ever heard is in this book when Ellie asks her dad, well, did we gamble with our money? And he says, well, no, honey, but everything affects everything else. When other people lost their jobs, there was no – people were moving away. They had to send their kids away. There was no need for a teacher. Nobody wanted fancy dresses. I get the feeling that they were a fairly well-to-do family because of the father's skills and the mother's skills. And you get this especially from the – and then – they go from being a very well-to-do family to, I actually made this. This is what Ellie carries continuously to make fire. I don't know if it's exactly what hers looked like, but this is a piece of chert that has been turned into a knife blade. I'm not a very good flint napper, so these can be way prettier. Hers was probably way prettier. but she's going to use this to shave off little tiny pieces of metal to make a fire. How interesting would it be? We've got this kid reading, and her flint and steel fire is a continuous thing. Her ability to make fire, one of the first things she teaches her sister is how to make a fire when everything's not perfect, because they're used to this perfect stove, you know, that her father made. And this starts to re-solidify their bonds. I just think it'd be really cool if Little Adventures could have just a brief moment of being like, oh, because this, and one of the time I met Gary Paulson, one of the things they were talking about is how comic books can be used in teaching. It's very important to help these kids not just read words. A, apple, a, that's all very important, but there's more to reading than just reading sentences. There's voices and smells and lessons and to be part of people's bat belt, you know, to be a tool they can use to be like, okay, in this chapter, something's going to happen that's kind of awkward, and here's what it looks like. Just a real quick, you know, not really a how-to guide. They're going to have to buy the book if they really want to make the hide girl, you know.
Right.
Just something really, really brief that just is kind of helps those pictures come to life, so that when that kid reads the story, he can smell the campfire and he can tremble for a moment at the thought of the bear coming down the path, or the it's not orcs that come out of the walls, the goblins that can come out of the walls.
Right.
or why can't a rock actually make fire, and does it have to be the specific rock, and is that guy really going to make fire from rabbit poop? Icky poo poo caca, you know? And what are the things? And does honey really do that? And of course, this is my world, so it seems like a very exciting prospect. But as I have learned over the years, sometimes I get super excited about something and I realize that I do this for a living because I'm excited about these things. And other people are like, yeah, we just want to read the book, dude. Like, just shut up and go away. But it's an idea that I'm playing with.
I think it's fascinating. And I especially think what you were saying earlier to Val and I about homeschoolers being a really good client for you, because they usually have like specifically picked a book because they want to do a deep dive into it. And so you're doing that deep dive and you're helping to encourage people in doing deeper dives themselves and just giving them little springboards into that. And I definitely think that there are a lot of people who would appreciate that and love it. And with my girls being older and their teens now, I'm always looking for those types of things that they can watch and then do themselves.
Experiential learning. Yeah. Experiential learning is so,
like, you know, they can get some hands on and do it with their younger siblings. And
I love working with homeschoolers, because there's a question I often ask is, what did you hope to get from this activity? Or what did you get when clients approach me? Especially because a lot of times I guest teach at many schools. I'm not the best at running my own business, but I'm really good at the skills and that works for me. So a lot of times I get these vague emails. Hey, we have someone that wants to learn this, or can you teach canning at this museum, or da da. So I love to ask this question of, what did you hope to get from this skill? Is this a science class? Is this a history class? Is this a we just need jelly class? Is this in connection to a book? And one of the things I love about working with, and homeschooling has changed so much. It's not just the parents I'm talking to now. Now there's these connections and all kinds of different factions and different stuff. And I almost always get these solid answers to this question of what did you hope to get from this book? So we've got this book that's got so much going on. If someone can come to me and say, we really want to focus on the connections or the positive thinking or just the skills, then it lets me know what my 3-hour presentation or whatever is going to be on in relation to that book. So it's, for me, it's a great, great group to work with because it allows me to keep these stories alive and these skills alive, which at the end of the day is my mission statement. I do get emails from clients who these skills have saved their lives, and those emails are very important to me. But if I've done my job well, I shouldn't get too many of those emails, which fortunately I don't get a lot of. But I do get a lot of emails of this skill saved our vacation, or you know, I stepped on my glasses and had to make that thing you showed me, or it just made things more fun, or you wouldn't believe this. Ever since I could never get Timmy or Tommy to read. But ever since you taught them how to make the fire, they've read Echo Mountain, My Side of the Mountain, a Hatchet. What else you got? What other books would you recommend? And those are actually some of the emails that when my bucket's a little empty, we all have those days. Everybody has a day where they wish they were doing something else, no matter how good things are, right? You pick the happiest person in the world that you think has the best job, whatever that means to you. Could be a basketball player, could be a guy on TV, could be whatever, a person that gets to take pretty pictures of models all day long. I guarantee you that person has some aspect of their day that just makes them wish they were fishing or something else, or makes them wish they were the basketball player. And when I hit those moments, it's those emails, the picture of some inner city single dad that had no outdoor skills, putting a tent up in the middle of his room using paint cans and a sheet, and had this week-long adventure. Those are the priceless ones to me. And the homeschools for me are just so rewarding because you guys that are doing that get to set your own curriculum. You get to look for exactly there's not that there's not hard parts for you as well. Whereas a lot of classroom teachers, they're like, yeah, we would really love to use that book you recommended, but we still have to use Island of the Blue Dolphins, or not that that's a bad book, just using it as a reference pickup, or we still have to use The Purple Couch on that side of the room. I don't believe that's an actual book. So let's pretend that's a bad book. Let's pretend that's a terrible book that for some reason some PTA has decided needs to be on the curriculum. Their hands are kind of bound, and you can still find stuff to teach from those books. It's where the autism is. It's sometimes a gift, but often a curse. And that's one of the ways that it's a gift is I am so obsessed with the thing. I can read completely random things. I'm just like, oh, that's conduction right there, man. I'll teach them how to build a shelter, and boom, we got this microwave manual. Easy peasy. No problem. Survival book, right? Definitely that's an area that I hope to see growing. And it's unfortunate, too, what you guys are doing. A lot of people aren't going to realize how important this podcast is for the next 20 years. I had no idea how important that librarian was to me until I was much older, and I was actually sitting by a fire. My 8-year-old son had just helped me teach a class, and I was just watching him, and I was just so proud of him. And I realized it just sort of hit me like a truck how important that woman had been in my life. And it's very easy to get science programs, science outreach programs. People bring me in, show us fire, talk about fire, go away. But literacy, for whatever reason, is brushed over. And my grandpa, he could tell there was something. People didn't say autism or spectrum back then. Unfortunately, there were a lot of negative words they used. My grandpa just figured I needed some discipline. He just figured I needed to learn these skills to learn discipline. And I needed to learn that when you work, you get good things like pancakes. When you don't work, you get to be hungry all day, because you didn't go mountain goats, or you didn't make any acorn flour. If you don't have flour, you can't make stuff. God bless him for that. But with what you guys are doing with literacy, it's hard to sometimes get people to understand that if you can learn to not read, but to comprehend, you can learn it. I mean, I faked my way into pharmacy school, and that was terrible. But because I could read, and because I could understand, and I could, I was 3 years into a doctor when I was just like, I'm so unhappy. I got to do something else. I was struggling, but I managed to get there because people had focused on getting me to learn how to read. And today, I get to leave my dreams because literacy is twofold, a two-sided sword. Not only can I take in what other people have given from their brain cave, Now, of course, when I write, I rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, so it's not quite as spasmodic as talking to me off of outline. Like in my classes, I write outlines and I memorize them and I work from them. Same thing I do when I write a book to keep me from jumping all over and getting too excited. And when I write something, when I put an idea in, it allows me to bring people into my own brain cave, and they get to sit around the fire with me and they get to learn these skills. And I don't think enough people are stressing the importance of those two skills. It's just so amazing. And I do think that it's going to be to the detriment of some people, because you end up with a lot more of the sister and the mom than you do Ellie's. You end up with a lot more Esther's, people who they can only do it the way it was shown to them. And that's it. That's where the story stops, versus someone that can intuitively take it in and they can say, I heard a story once, or I saw a thing once, and then they can teach it to other people. So I do really appreciate getting to keep these skills alive and these stories alive. It's an honor. Plus, it's great that since this is about one of the only things that goes through my mind, I can also pay the bills. I don't mind that whatsoever. They get us not obsessed with paint, although I'm sure there's probably a way to make money at that too. That's a blessing, because I don't know how I'd function otherwise.
So before we're done, can I just say this, your type of skill was never anything I thought I would be interested in ever in my life. But I started homeschooling. One of the first questions asked is, have you read My Side of the Mountain? And I read it and I thought, is this real? So that summer I taught my kids to make a campfire without using lighter fluid and a match, right? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of stopped there. So you've re-inspired me, because I have not read this with my children yet. I just read it by myself. So this spring semester we'll be doing Echo Mountain. But I think the main thing in Echo Mountain, which we hit on, but we didn't really go into super in-depth, but you're talking about it now, Hutch, with your whole life, like intuition, trusting intuition, knowing what intuition is, knowing when to do something and when to pull back, and knowing when to ask questions. Is that real? Can you really do that? What exactly, why would I need to do that? I know how to ask the questions, but I can't find the people to give me the answers, because we do now live in a society of people who are like, Google it, or I don't know, why would you need to know that anymore? Like the campfire, I went with a group that used to camp, and nobody lit fires the real way. So I started camping away from them so I could do the skills I wanted to keep learning. And now I don't camp with them anymore, because it became really weird. They were very just like modern campers. And I was like, but there's so much more to this. And I live in town, so survival ship skills don't seem necessary. And that is an idea I think a lot of people think as well. I live in a city, I don't really need these skills. But then I think the pandemic showed us we actually do. And I wanted to say, because toilet paper with the pandemic.
Yes.
And I kept saying to people, well, what did they do before toilet paper exist? And people were horrified that toilet paper is such a modern thing. And I was like, who do I know that doesn't use toilet paper? And I have one friend, her name is Tracy, and Amber knows her, that they have figured out a way for the last 10 years of their marriage to not use toilet paper. You just flush down the toilet. And so I called her, what do you use for toilet paper? And it was this really interesting idea of how these little survival skills, we never think we need them until we need them. And then we're like, well, why didn't I learn that back then? So I just really appreciate you speaking on that today.
I wanted to say a few things. I jotted some things down on that. Toilet paper is not just modern, but it's also regional specific. There are numerous countries that don't, you know, we've got, and that can range from, there's some countries where you have to be careful which hand. So I get to train with people from around the world. I travel a lot, and sometimes we'll be briefed, never offer this hand, or don't smile until blah, blah, blah. And one of the things is, in many places, there's just a hand you wipe with and a hand you eat with, and then you wash that. Now that is already, there's going to be several listeners already like, oh no. Okay. So let's take it all the way to the other end of the spectrum. You've also got like things like the bidet, you know, and the drip rag. And so, but it's actually kind of funny, as Americans, we don't always think this, but when you travel a lot, one of the eye-opening things sometimes to me is the differences. The similarities are always, you know, wonderful too, but sometimes you show up somewhere and you just, the first time I walked into a toilet in Okinawa, Japan, I was completely blown away, because you've got this, it's porcelain, right? But there's this hole on the ground with no way to flush it or anything else like that, and this sink. And my first thought is, oh my goodness. Well, a couple things happen. First off, it's really easy to dookie when you're squatting. So that's kind of nice, as I ate. But the thing that's fascinating about this thing is it's water conservation. When they turn on the sink, it flushes the toilet. It's the same water that washes it away. But this difference was just blew me away. Of course, there's always the Australia, does the water go the opposite direction thing, you know? But yeah, these differences sometimes really stand out when you travel. And these are just like with Ellie, these life experiences are what change us, because people who are more well-read, so to speak, that have more of these diverse interactions, they look at something like toilet paper and like, it's no big deal. We didn't have it at all when we were in Europe, you know? Right. And then other people, they get in that Esther's thing of, that's why reading is so important. You can, oh my gosh, there's a quote from Mice of the Mountain. I used it yesterday in my literacy program. The author, when she's talking about Runaway from Home, she says, I'm going to mess this up. I'm going to paraphrase because I don't have it in front of me. She says something along the lines of, I found that my first night in the woods was quite scary, but it was very enjoyable to run away in a book. Mm-hmm. And when you use these books, you can traverse Mars with John Carpenter. Yes. You can slay orcs with the hobbits. You can camp with Sam Gribble. You can solve mysteries with Sherlock Holmes. I always wanted to be a police officer, but I can't pass the psych eval. So I fulfill that part of my life by solving mysteries with some of my favorite detectives, and my wife doesn't have to worry about me getting shot. You know, it's great. So there's that. I wanted to show you. This is not going to make sense to most people, but I don't know if this will show up on the camera. But if I ever get to meet you, let me teach this to you. Your kiddos. This is, can you see the sparks? Are they showing up?
Yeah.
I can see them on my end. Trust me, it's working. So the fire doesn't come from the rock, but it comes from this, any pyrophilic metal. You learn that skill and you find anything that rusts and you can make a fire. And that is, Ellie does this numerous times. Sam Gribble does this. This right here was what paved my way from that book, is the idea that a pocket knife, which I'm not going to dig out because I'm trying to be brief, and a little piece of metal could allow me to go anywhere and start to maintain levels of comfort, fueled my whole life. So there's that on the camping and the flint and steel thing. And there was something you said, though, that's really important to me is, this mindset of, I actually, for years, throughout my life, I'll be called something else in a few years. A few years ago, we called ourselves preppers, but now you don't, because right now, that's the crazy term. You never said survival skills, because no one would let you anywhere near their kids. They figured you're, at the heart of it, what I really am is a naturalist. I even have some of the college to back that up, but it's hard to really identify what I do. I would just call it the old ways. But there is always that thing. And sometimes I struggle because, first off, a lot of people who teach survival skills aren't really qualified. They might know the skills, but they've never really done something with search and rescue. They don't really know. They're so busy trying to sell you a knife, but they've never spent the night in the woods with an hurt someone or a dead body wrapped up in a trash bag, just trying to stay warm throughout the night so you can carry them out. And the whole time all you're thinking is, why didn't they have a whistle? Like they're so close to the road. They're so close. Why didn't they have? So to me, that's survival, the 72-hour period, the things that get you, whatever went wrong, they get you away from what went wrong and back to the normal. But these skills, these heritage skills, they change the way you think. I have a daughter. She's in a wheelchair, and she's very artistic, and she just never cared much about the outdoor stuff. And I learned really early on, if I tried to teach her to make a tripod to make beef jerky, she would look at me and say, Dad, we can buy beef jerky. But if I taught her how to make a tripod so that she didn't have to carry one, because her wheelchair makes it difficult anyway, she loves to do art out in the woods. She could carry more art, more food, more comfort things, things for her wheelchair, because she could just go out and make these little things to make the art easier. So it does speak to us. We're learning. And one of the things I always tell people is I always say, lost proofing. Very, very, very important survival skill that's often glossed over because everybody wants to get right to knives and fire, right? Well, let's just get to the whole not getting in the bad situation in the first place. And when we do, what we do to get out of it? Lost proofing, right? It can be just as useful lost in the woods as when you walk out of the grocery store and aren't really sure where your car is. Primitive navigation, based a lot on the sun and the stars and shadows. Just as useful if you want to go romping with Hutch in the woods, or if you work a 9-hour shift and you want to come out to a cool car, just knowing where that shadow is going to settle. My oldest kid, as I mentioned, not really into this stuff, but she sent me a text message a while ago, and she says, Dad, if you needed to suspend a body or something really heavy like a buffalo up in the air where no one could see it, but at a moment's notice it would drop down, what knot would you use? Two questions when I called my kid. First one was, are you in trouble?
Right.
Second one was, what is this for? What she was supposed to do, she was supposed to suspend this thing for a play up in the air, and it needed to hold all this weight and be basically unnoticed, just sort of a part of the play. It's kind of like in A Christmas Carol, when Marley comes out at you from the play, or in Phantom of the Opera, you know, there's these scenes that just everybody, even when you've seen it before, you know it's coming, and you still, you know. It was for that kind of a moment. She needed to suspend this item. It needed to have all this weight, and it needed to drop instantly on command and put this stuff all over the thing. So what I teach her, I taught her what some people would call survival skills. Other people would say, oh, I use that in boating. These skills are more universal. The rules of three apply to everything. No, there's nowhere in the world where the rules of three don't apply for human life, which is why they can be applied to any book, any situation. Now, do we always need zombies and a fire? No, in our home, when the heater goes out, we've lost our fire, so to speak. And we have to start thinking about conduction and convection and until the plumber, whoever gets there and fixes it, right? Or we fix it ourselves. So I do hear that a lot. But then the funny thing is, at the end of a lot of classes, I hear from people being like, you know, hopefully I'm never in a situation where I have to use this stuff, but I could actually see myself using this at the law firm, or as I mentioned, someone handed me a roofing book and wanted to say, how would you do survival skills with this? Well, it's desert survival. We just were contacted by our local energy company. I don't know if we'll get this contract or not, but they had a few trucks overturned last year and their people just had trouble staying warm while they waited for other trucks. That was a real survival situation. But when we were pitching the class, they were like, this applies to more than just when the trucks break down. Some of this stuff, the layering, the using these things, will make them more efficient at their job because their hands will be more dexterous. It will have them be able to work longer hours without breaks safely, da 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 da. So while we do get kind of pigeonholed, and that is important, sometimes you also have to remember, you don't want to get so into teaching the hide glue that you don't teach a kid how to not get lost and how to signal for help when they do get lost, right? Carving and all that stuff is great, but let's talk about the immediate, you know, issues before we go long-term living. Let's talk about how you can just kind of do those things. But then in your day-to-day life, it's amazing how my kids just at school, they'll do little things. And it's funny because my wife was always worried they'd get bullied because of this, but because they're confident in themselves and because we've let them be them. My one son dressed as himself for Halloween. He doesn't know he dressed as himself. He's not a narcissist. He dressed as what he wanted to be for Halloween, which is it's this fictitious character that he's made up in the stories that he writes. But as the parent on the outside, the teacher and I were talking, and it's like, he's basically wearing the same clothes. He is his own hero. And what an awesome dad moment, right? The funny thing is my wife was worried they'd get bullied for some of these weird things. Like when you tuck your pants into your socks, it can keep you crazy warm because what happens is our body is heating the air. Dead air space is what every shelter, whether it's your clothing or your house, can only do two things. It can offer shielding or insulation. Those are the only two things that it can do. And that's how they work. That's a tangent for another time for anyone that's like, no, it offers more. We can have that discussion and I will explain to you why I'm right. But it can only do these two things. And that airspace is where insulation comes to. So in the desert, we want our air to be pumped away from our body so that when new air gets sucked in, our body heats it up and heat is taken away. In the cold, we want to trap that air. So my kid tucks his pants into his socks and does all these other little things. Well, the funny thing is, because he's so confident, right? We've got this entire third grade class walking around looking just like Scout. And, you know, some of the parents, because some of these parents are very, I'm not always the most popular person in a room. Some people think I'm a little weird and they wish I would take the teepee in front of my house down, but my kids are playing outside and they can deal with their property value on another day. I do try and be cognizant of that, and I do try and be polite about it. I try and take stuff down if people complain, but I grew up very differently. And so sometimes parents are, a little of them are like, you could actually hear parents, you look ridiculous, untuck your, and the best thing in the world is to hear this stranger kid I've never heard look at up at him and go, you don't understand. Convection is heat loss through air movement, and I was cold today. And I'm like, I didn't even teach this kid a class. But somewhere in that classroom, you know, sometimes they're not even kids from my own kids' class. I'm like, I don't know. They were on recess together or something. And this little boy, he's so much like Ellie. I think it's part of why this book is hard for me when Ellie's getting bullied, because I see Scout in her, his heart, and I want to bite someone on the face when they're mean to Scouts. So, but he's got this giving nature. He's a much better teacher than I am, much better salesman too. But he will just approach a kid that's cold on the thing and he'll start teaching them how to make a muckluck out of some newspaper to stay warm. And these things happen in our lives. Cars break down, we get lost, power goes out. These are sort of survivally based. But there's also this part of our life where it just makes things easier. It makes us more comfortable. People assume I'd be a tough guy. I'm not. I hate being hungry. I hate being cold. I hate being thirsty. And that's what made me good at these skills. So in my day-to-day life, whether I'm going to the movies or the mountains or a play, these skills actually come into play way more than people would realize in my day-to-day life, because they're not just a YouTube video to me. They are my lifestyle. It is actually, it's funny because that comment that you made, I hear so much at the beginning of the class and then at the end of the class. And, and My Side of the Mountain is just, that's another great book. If you guys ever want to, you come out to the property or I come out to your mountains or whatever you got, going through that book and doing some of these things, it changes people's lives, because what I really do is I teach people to be self-reliant and self-sufficient in any situation. I teach them to be not MacGyver, because that would be copyright infringement, but MacGyver. It's really my job to teach people. And sometimes it is literally my job to teach. They literally comes with the military. These are the items that would be carrying. Teach them everything you can with these items. What would they do? And other times it's less obvious, where it is more a matter of, can you be comfortable everywhere you go? Can you be well fed everywhere you go? Can you be confident that you can? Your pin breaks. A primitive skill, a pioneer skill. There's something, I carry this Altoid tin. I have little leather pouches like this that I make, and it's just got an Altoid tin in it, carried with some kind of survival kit. I've got some cool stuff in there, right? But you know what I've used the most out of those two tins, especially when I was struggling to get the business going, I'd be tending bar or something else. There's something special when you have a cocktail waitress walk up to you, and I worked at casinos, so they've got these terrible wardrobes anyway. They're poor things, you know, and they've busted, and they're mortified, and they don't know how they're going to get through the shift. And you reach over to a decorative piece of yucca, break it off, turn it in some cordage real quick, and sew their strap back on. And they turn around and they look at you, and for me, it was a James Bond moment, because all the cocktail waitresses I worked with were Ukrainian. But and they just like, Aaron, what kind of man are you? You know, you how do these things that you do? And the things that I use for my emergency kit the most often are Band-Aids, the sewing kit, and Aleve, or any medication. Aleve works on my migraines, so that's what I carry. It's also great for menstrual cramps, which I run into people all the time that either have a headache or menstrual cramps, or they have a little cut and need a Band-Aid. And just this idea of preparedness or self-reliance or the ability to look at a couch and see a couch when it's a couch, but also to see a capote coat or a shelter or the ability to make fire when you need those things. It is a universal skill. No zombies required.
Perfect.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. I think it's great to think about how to find skills from these books and find ways to utilize them in our real life. And I appreciate everything that you shared. And we will have to have conversations about other books another time. And we'll just have the books that we talked about in the show notes and a link to our last episode with Hutch, where even if you don't have time to listen to that, if you want to look at the book list, Hutchman mentioned some different really good starter books for people that are interested in getting familiar with how to take care of themselves out and about. And I never thought I would say this sentence, but I really look forward to reading your book about hide glue.
Good.
We'll let everybody know when that book comes out, but we thank you for your time, Val and Hutch, and remember, everyone, the stories are truer than true.